I'm Rick Gantley. This is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Decades after President Richard Nixon declared war on drugs, the nation is reassessing the costs of that war and whether it was worth fighting. At the federal level, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder wants to end mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenders. And in many states, drug sentences are being relaxed, and in some, prisons are even being closed. It's something that our guest today is thinking about as well. Despite a rise in prison populations here, New Hampshire Corrections Commissioner William Wren is a proponent of alternative sentencing and acknowledges the huge costs involved in simply locking people up. Today in The Exchange, Commissioner Wren is here, and we're taking your calls and emails. Do you agree that we should relax sentences for certain nonviolent crimes, or do you think that could open up new problems, especially given the lack of funding for rehabilitation, like treatment for mental health and substance abuse? Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Commissioner Wren, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Good morning, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Well, what do you make of this big push by the Attorney General to get rid of mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenders? This has caused a lot of conversation.
It has. And as you've heard me say many times on the show, we lock up too many people. There are so many people that come into the criminal justice system that essentially need treatment, not to be locked up and put away from society. I've often said that treatment is a key in many of these cases and can certainly lower our population in the prison if we were just able to find a way to get them treatment and deal with their issues and not deal with the criminality that's involved in their behavior. And I'm also talking about getting them at a time before they even really enter that behavior and creating victims out there. And there's so much involved in their behavior and the harm that they do. But treatment is really the key. And I think the Attorney General is recognizing that. I think government is finally recognizing the fact that we can do a better job at that. And frankly, it would be a lot cheaper.
Well, you once told me how many inmates in the state's prisons had some sort of substance abuse problem. And I remember being shocked by that number. What is it? 70%, 80%?
Yeah, it's approximately between 75 and 85%
wow.
have some substance abuse issue. And about 65% have some mental illness. So, you know, it's not rocket science here that it's what's driving the behavior. Quite often we said, you know, the three-legged stool of those that are in the prison are mental health, substance abuse, and education, frankly. And generally, a lot of what's happening now with substance abuse is happening so early in the lives of these individuals that it's impacting their education. So they come out with lacking a high school diploma, they're abusing drugs or maybe even have formed an addiction by then. They may have some level of mental illness, and all of this starts to contribute to them going down a bad road of criminal behavior.
So looking at what the Attorney General wants to do, again, pretty much getting rid of mandatory minimums for nonviolent drug offenders. So what does that mean on the ground for you, Commissioner Wren? Does that mean if someone came in with they were caught with heroin, so they're sent to prison, does that mean they just serve no sentence? I mean, what would that mean in practice? I'm a little unclear.
No, I think what it does is it gives the judges some discretion on how to deal with that individual when they're seated before them in the courtroom. The judge is going to understand the case and through the prosecution and defense attorney, they're going to understand what the drivers are of the behavior. And I think on an individual basis, they can better serve that person by having options available to them. The one problem in this state, however, is that judges don't have many options. As we've talked about before, there is a lack of resources in the community to deal with mental health issues, to deal with substance abuse issues. And that, frankly, in this state, presents a problem to a sitting judge as to what to do with that individual. And quite often, their only option is to send them to either the jail or the prison.
So a judge might look at an offender and say, you know, I can see some potential here, and your crime is not that big, and I'd really like to sentence you to drug treatment, but there isn't any.
That's exactly correct. I was talking to three Superior Court judges just the other day, and that's exactly what they were saying to me. Quite often, they have an individual before them that they know could benefit from a real good, sound treatment program instead of incarcerating them, but they have nothing available to them at that particular moment, so their only alternative is to send them to the prison.
So what Holder's talking about is not necessarily, you know, giving a get-out-of-jail-free card for everybody, but giving judges more discretion over, you know, mandatory minimum. A judge could still sentence someone, but it isn't mandatory that he or she do so. Is that right?
That's exactly right. It's not a one – we're realizing it's not a one fit, you know, one thing fits all. And you really need to look at the individual, what's driving the behavior, what the judge thinks based on the individual's background, based on the crime, based on what's happened. What can best suit this individual to get them on the right road in being able to live in society again and be successful and not creating more victims in the future? You know, what will do that? And quite often it's treatment. But if you don't have those resources available, the only option is jail or prison.
How robust is the drug treatment available within prison walls?
Well, we're doing a lot more today than we did before. And when I say that, it's a different concept that we look at today. We're learning as research continues in these areas that our use of programs, substance abuse programs, has to be targeted. It can't be just generally given to everybody that comes in the prison that in some cases may have had a crime that involved alcohol or drugs. We have to do risk assessment, and we have to further assess that substance abuse issue to determine what the level of risk is, what the level of need is. For one reason is that these programs are geared for those that are in the high-risk, high-need area. If you take a low-risk offender, low needs, sometimes it's counterintuitive. It works the other way. So what we try to do now is we do risk assessments on every single person that enters the prison. The judges, as a matter of fact, where they used to mandate certain programs, now make those recommendations and leave them up to us to determine whether or not this person is an ideal fit for that substance abuse program. If that's the case and the risk assessment says that this individual is in the high-risk, high-need area and it's an addiction, then we will then send them to our LADAC employees, counselors, to further assess and come up with a treatment plan. And we've since moved all our LADAC counselors over to our medical and forensics unit.
What does LADAC mean?
Licensed Alcohol and Drug Counselor.
Okay.
And since they're under our medical and forensics unit now, they can also deal with any mental health issues and those are co-occurring with substance abuse. It makes it a lot easier.
How big a change is that, and when did you start doing things this way?
Oh, that's a big change. It's a big change for us and even the whole philosophy behind mental illness and substance abuse. Quite often, although it's getting better, at least in the past, there was a real division between the two. The mental health was on one side, substance abuse was on the other, and it's never the twain shall meet. What we're looking at today is, well, in the co-occurring nature of illness, where those that are suffering from a mental illness sometimes medicate with alcohol and drugs, we have to deal with both of those issues, and it can't be you know, put the person on one side for the mental health issue and put them on the other side for the substance abuse issues.
And sometimes they couldn't get mental health treatment until they resolved the substance abuse issue, which is really hard if you're abusing substances to deal with your mental health. It's a circle, isn't it?
You're right. You'd have the mental health people saying you got to deal with the substance abuse issues first. You'd have the substance abuse people saying you got to deal with the mental illness first. So you had this push back and forth all the time. We're trying to get it normalized so that we can deal with those issues because they're a big part of the population that we have in the prison.
Again, you can join our conversation with Corrections Commissioner William Wren, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Well, this push to reduce sentences for nonviolent drug offenders, as you know, Commissioner Wren, isn't just coming from Eric Holder at the federal level. Lots of states are looking at this. According to USA Today, 17 states are either closing prisons or considering it as they try to reduce costs, ease up on drug offenses. What about New Hampshire, Commissioner Wren? Is our prison population growing here?
Unfortunately, it is. Back a few years ago, we saw a decline in our population. Back when the Justice Reinvestment Act was voted in, commonly known as SB 500. I think a lot of people knew it by that name. Unfortunately, it became effective in the middle of a campaign for governor and became a political issue that was argued by both the governor and the opponent at the time. And a lot of misunderstandings were made public. We've tried at that time to keep intact SB 500 and what we had done. We saw a tremendous decrease in our population, greater than we had even expected. However, once the election was over, SB 500 was neutralized by SB 52, and the population started to rise again.
All right. Lots more to talk about in just a moment. And you can join us as well, 1-800-892-6477. Email us, exchange at nhpr.org, or post a comment for Commissioner Wren on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. You can make sure your membership gift to NHPR goes as far as it can with our corporate match program. Many businesses around the state match their employees' donations to NHPR. You can essentially double the impact of your membership gift. Find out if your company participates at nhpr.org. More with New Hampshire Corrections Commissioner William Wren on The Exchange and the 10 on the Diane Reams Show, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to strike down overall limits on campaign contributions. Partly to mostly sunny across New Hampshire today, highs upper 30s for the North Country, ranging upper 40s in southern parts of the state. Support for NHPR comes from UR listeners and AMB Lumber and Home Centers, featuring windows and doors by Marvin and Integrity for remodeling or replacement projects in Pembroke, Moultonboro, and at ablumber.com. And Wright Networks, delivering familiar business applications to companies of all sizes, moving your organization into the cloud easily, reliably, and securely. WrightNetworks.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a conversation with New Hampshire's Commissioner of Corrections, William Wren. We invite you to join us with your questions and comments for the commissioner, 1-800-892-6477. We've been talking about a national push to relax sentences for nonviolent drug offenders. We'd like your thoughts on that. Do you agree with that push, or do you think that could open up new problems? 1-800-892-6477. We've also been talking about the lack of mental health and substance abuse treatment leading to violent acts that lead people to prison. We'd like your thoughts on how the correction system can tackle that issue as well. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And before we go to our listeners, Commissioner Wren, just before the break, I was mentioning that several states are closing prisons, reducing their prison populations, a big shift from the tough-on-crime trend of, you know, three decades ago. You said in New Hampshire our prison populations are growing. How do you match that up with what's happening in some other states?
Well, I think if you look at those other states, you'll see that they have put a lot of money into resources in the community to deal with exactly what we've been talking about, mental health issues and substance abuse issues. In this state, if a judge doesn't have the options available to him at sentencing, that individual is going to come to the prison. And even with our parolees, quite often our parolees will go back into the community and start to relapse. They come back into our probation offices and say, hey, I'm starting to relapse. I need to get into a program. And then we're told it might be 16, 18 months to get that individual into a program.
16, 18 months?
Yeah, it's crazy. And so they have no alternative but to bring them back to the prison as well. It's our lack of resources in the community. I've often said that no matter what kind of job we do in the prison to help somebody with their mental health issues or substance abuse issues, when they walk out into the community, it's like walking off the cliff. There is nothing out there available to them unless they have insurance coverage or they're wealthy. And that's where I think the whole Medicaid expansion is going to help us greatly.
Well, I definitely want to ask you about that. But let's go to our listeners. Commissioner Wran, again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Rose is calling from Manchester. Hi, Rose. You're on the exchange with Commissioner Wran. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. My son has been involved with the prison system for 20 years. He's a drug addict, a nonviolent drug addict. Right now he's in prison since August of 2012 for a misdemeanor enhanced to a felony. And he has spent most of this time in a level 4 and 5 because of taking small amounts of Suboxone. They don't test the levels for Suboxone anymore. And sometimes they have a low amount, especially when he first came in, and it's coming up as positive. So he starts right off going into C4. And there's no treatment in C4. This has been going on for really decades for him. And I have to say that prison has made him far worse, that he's actually become a victim of society, more so than the crime that he has committed. Staying in C4 and C5 creates such mental issues. I think you can probably imagine being in isolation and being in there 22 hours a day.
Wow. Rose, can I jump in? Because there's a couple things that you mentioned that I think a lot of people might not understand. So C4 and C5, that sounds like that's a very strict level of confinement. Is that right?
Yes, it is. It's the highest level, high security.
And he got put in there because of Suboxone?
That's a drug that helps you to not use.
I see. Okay. All right. So definitely disputing what you feel is overly harsh treatment of your son. He needs help not to be put in almost solitary confinement.
Yes, and he can't get out. There's one reason after another. He can't get out. He should have been out last November. Not that he's totally innocent in that, but he doesn't deserve, the prison system isn't there at all to help them. It's there, really, making them crazy.
Rose, thank you so much for calling. And Commissioner Wran, I know you can't comment on a particular prisoner's position, but the issue of how people receive treatment or don't receive treatment is very tricky. And it sounds like once you get into that higher level of security, you're just kind of written off.
Well, they're not written off, and help is available. The problem is in the higher restricted areas, the class 4 and class 5 restricted areas, they're generally there because of the behavior. It's generally bad behavior that puts them there. I can't comment on this woman's son. I don't know who he is, but my guess would be it would be because of bad behavior that has placed him there. Quite often it's because of drug use, even within the prison. Suboxone is the drug of choice now in the prison. It can be very easily hidden and smuggled in to the prison. The way it's manufactured, in wafer form, similar to the breath wafers that you can put on your tongue and they melt away. It's not manufactured as pills. So these are very easily hidden on the body. I wouldn't even want to get into the various ways that it's smuggled into the prison, but It does make its way into the prison.
Is it a drug to get you high, or is it a drug, as Rose says, to help you get off worse drugs?
The whole purpose behind Suboxone was to help people that have addictions, similar to methadone. However, there is an intoxicant quality to that, and the inmates have realized that and are using that today to get high in the prison system. At one time, it became the drug of choice because when we drug test individuals, and we run a lot of drug tests in the prison system, we weren't testing for Suboxone. It was a new drug that was on the market, and we weren't testing for it. So all of a sudden, we started finding this stuff in the prison. Talked to the state lab, and they started testing for it. So now we do test for it, and it's part of our disciplinary process. We are taking many steps to try to stop the entry of these drugs into the prison system, but it still makes its way in, and a lot of it comes in through our visiting room, frankly.
So if you're caught with this, then you get bumped up to level 4 and level 5, as Rose said.
If you're caught with it, you get bumped up
to punishment.
Or if you come back with a dirty drug test, your classification is increased to those restrictive units.
Someone who works for a prison advocacy group wrote a recent letter to the newspaper really taking issue with almost solitary confinement, you know, 22 hours a day, maybe not 24, but 22, kind of saying what Rose said is that it makes people worse. It makes them kind of crazy.
Well, that unit is punitive, and quite often, like I said, it's an existence to control behavior, and we have to do our best to control behavior. In that C4 unit, we have about 120 individuals in that C4 unit, and in the special housing unit, which is our highest level. We have about 100. So we do have folks that need to be secure in those surroundings. We can't let them out into general population.
And that's 220 people in a general population of what, 2,000 or so?
Yeah, 20, roughly 27, 2,800 in that range. So, you know, you're looking at a large number in those units, but when you compare them over the population, we have a lot of people that are actually behaving themselves as well and are getting treatment and are abiding by the rules.
Let's take another call. Rose, thank you for that call. Good luck with your son. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Mark is calling from Northampton. Hi, Mark. You're on the line with Commissioner Wren. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm just calling to let you know I had bipolar disorder, and I ended up in jail. And I started out with a manic episode, and I was unable to get the psychiatric meds I needed. I needed sleep medication, and I was unable to get that due to the addiction problems in jail. And it just made my manic episode so much worse. And I would have had a much shorter time in jail if I was able to get the meds that I needed.
Did you end up in prison, Mark, or did it end with the jail term?
It was just jail, but okay. It was a much longer term than it would have been.
Yeah. So what finally sort of pulled you out of this?
I was able to see what they call a doc in the box, and he was able to prescribe me the meds that I needed.
A doc and in a box?
Yes.
Wow.
And that helped tremendously.
Okay. Mark, thank you for calling. This gets back to what we were talking about a lot earlier, Commissioner Wren. Once again, you know, the issue of mental health and substance abuse. Here's our caller who had a mental health issue, couldn't get help resolving it, and so ended up in trouble.
And that's exactly what we're talking about. You know, maybe Mark would have been a good candidate at that early period of time to get him into treatment, not get him into the jail, but get him into treatment and resolve his issues there. It seems like on the right medication, Mark seems to be doing fine. So perhaps if that had been done before he was sent to jail, it would have saved him having to go to jail, would have saved the jail money and time and effort as well. So these are the options that I'm talking about. These are the options that should be available to judges out there, and we need resources out there in the community to deal with it.
Okay, so this gets to something that you mentioned earlier, and this is actually good news from your perspective, Medicaid expansion. How is that going to affect the work that you do at Corrections? Sounds like it would be a boon for Commissioner Tumpas at Health and Human Services, but how does that affect the Corrections Department?
Well, it affects us tremendously. The Medicaid definition that existed for so many years really only had to do with women who had a child or those that were considered disabled. That was a very small number that were in the prison system. But through the years, we also would work with Medicaid to try to get them enrolled in the Medicaid program, and we would help them when they left the prison. But again, it was a very small number.
So Medicaid used to just apply to a small population of low-income Granite Staters.
That's correct. Now, with the expanded definition, the numbers that we're looking at right now, it could impact about 90% of our population. That is huge for us. Now, it would help us both inside the prison, because what happens inside the prison if somebody has to go out for inpatient care in a hospital and their stay is over 24 hours, that can be charged off to Medicaid. But the biggest bang for the buck for not only the corrections but the state is when they leave and they're back in the community again, they will have the ability to seek out help for their mental health issues and, because of the parity issue, substance abuse issues, that will all be covered under Medicaid as long as they fit within that definition, that expanded definition. That is huge for us. It's a huge savings for corrections in the state, but it's also a huge benefit for our society here in New Hampshire that perhaps there'll be some availability of resources that, even if they're not available today, may grow in time because they'll know the demand is there and they know that these things will be paid for as well.
I can see why you're hopeful, given your big concern over substance abuse treatment and mental health treatment and the lack thereof. How are you going to measure success, Commissioner Wren? You know, 5 years down the line, if you have 200 less prisoners, I mean, how are you going to know that this optimism that you have today was well-founded?
Well, what we do today, first of all, let me tell you, government has never been very good at measuring things. We throw programs at problems, and we think they work, but we don't really know. Today, we're doing things much different. We put performance measures on everything, and we look at the outcomes of what these programs produce so that we're going to be able to see in time what kind of results we're getting from a program. We're doing that internally in the prison system now. You know, some people say, well, we don't have many programs. Well, frankly, we got rid of a lot of programs because they, in fact, weren't working. And we were putting a lot of money into a program that wasn't working statistically. So we look at things now with those performance outcomes in mind, and we say, how can we achieve the level of success that we're looking for here? What do we need to show that proves our level of success? And then we put that performance measure on that particular program. We would do the same thing here with those that are leaving the prison to determine if our recidivism rate, which is a real key factor, gets reduced because of that. But we would also look at those coming back for drug problems or mental health problems to see if those levels are reduced as we continue along.
Again, our number for you to join us on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Commissioner Wren, let's hear from Lori calling in from Newmarket. Hi, Lori. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air.
Absolutely. Hi, I'm a licensed mental health counselor, and I work with children and adolescents. And I just want to say that, you know, when I hear the commissioner talk about good candidates, every human being is a good candidate for compassionate treatment. Prison and punitive reactions to people's cries for help and desperation do not work. Prisons are punitive and they re-traumatize people, and they're even putting children as young as 16 in adult prisons where, you know, I've had clients that have been raped, you know, boys that have been raped, isolated, and they come out with much higher levels of anxiety. I think I want to say is that the whole idea of the prison system doesn't address the core issues of why people are committing violent or nonviolent crimes to begin with, which is usually early childhood trauma. There is almost unanimously some type of physical, sexual, or emotional abuse in a prisoner's history. Generally, there is, if not, there is some type of unmet need. Schools are notorious for not meeting children's needs. And usually those who are turning to substances, that is often what I call a late-stage symptom of distress. Substance abuse is usually one of the you know, when you know that trauma is really severe and that all people's efforts to try to handle the distress that they're feeling has really failed. Any of the youth that I've worked with that have turned to substances, it is always at the root. There is always early childhood trauma or trauma in the present, and they get in with other youth who are using, often because they have disruptive, you know, disruptive,
sure, troubled family lives and so forth. Can I ask you a quick question, Lori, as we head into a break? And I do want to actually talk about something that you raised about younger prisoners, because there's a bill in the legislature on that. But as Commissioner Wren expresses his hopes for Medicaid expansion and that folks might be able to get better coverage for substance abuse, mental health treatment and so forth, let's assume that everybody just gets this coverage. Will there be enough counselors like you to see these folks?
I don't think so, because actually in the mental health field, there are actually very few counselors that actually understand the early childhood trauma piece.
Yes, I've heard that.
The first step that most counselors do is refer the client for psychiatric drugs, which I feel just puts a Band-Aid on the problem. It actually alters the person's chemistry without actually healing the wound. I do want to talk about, I do want to let your listeners know that EMDR, eye movement desensitization reprocessing, that is a program that should be in every single prison.
Okay, Lori, we're heading into the break, so I'm going to let you go, but we will definitely talk about some of the themes that you raise after that short break. Thank you very much for calling in. And Commissioner Wren, a couple issues to pull on there. We will follow up in just a moment. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Back in just a moment.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Supreme Court's decision to strike down overall limits on campaign contributions. Then an historical novel about Teddy Roosevelt's expedition into the Amazon. All coming up on The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Jensen Communities, with six locations in New Hampshire, including the new Brookridge community in Hooksett. One floor living in safe, friendly neighborhoods in jensencommunities.com. And Mascoma Savings Bank, serving the people in needs of the Upper Connecticut River Valley since 1899, online at mascomabank.com. Good morning, it's 940, and this is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at New Hampshire's Corrections Department, changes in the way we view crime and punishment around the country and here in New Hampshire. Commissioner William Wren is with us, and you can join us too, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. All one word. Commissioner Wren, before we go back to our listeners, I do want to acknowledge, Lori, a passionate call from someone who works with youth who often get into trouble. And Lori, thank you for sharing some of their stories with us. She said, look, prisons don't work. They don't affect the core issues of why people end up there in the first place, family trauma, lack of attachment, and so forth. I'm guessing you've seen all that every single day.
We see it every day. We live it every day. You know, I agree with Lori. In many of the points that she made, The listeners should understand that the prison system is the largest mental health provider in the state of New Hampshire. And it's sad to have to say that.
Bigger than DHHS.
Bigger than DHHS, you know, in the numbers that we deal with in the prison. And it's a sad commentary on our life here in New Hampshire that we have to say that. I agree with Lori that if help could be given to those that are in those early ages before they get themselves into the criminal justice system, it would benefit all of society, you know, and benefit them and their families as well from a lifetime of heartache. But, you know, there are also, I have to do say, you know, regarding Lori's argument, there are some that have to be in prison just because of their violent tendencies. But the ones we're talking about are the ones that would benefit from treatment. They're low-end offenders, nonviolent offenders that have a problem, and we need to address that problem.
Lori also mentioned she's counseled some teenagers who are in the prison system. And as I understand, Commissioner Wren, change may be afoot in that area. The legislature is considering a bill to raise the age at which teens can be treated as adults under the criminal justice system. Right now, it's 17-year-olds who can be considered adults, maybe increased to 18. What's the thinking behind this?
Well, first of all, we supported that bill going in. We think that 18 is a better age to deal with adult issues and that anybody under 18, we should be looking at differently. So on the face value of that bill, we support that. The problem, though, that I deal with are not so much the age of majority and those that fit in that age of majority. It's those juvenile offenders that are committing violent crime that end up being certified as adults. Under the new federal, I guess it's not new anymore, the federal laws called the Prison Rape Elimination Act, we now have to keep those individuals sight and sound separate in our prison facilities.
Teens completely separate because of this federal law.
Because of this federal law. Now, I've raised this issue with the legislature to say, while we certainly agree raising the age of majority to 18 is a good idea, there's a much larger issue here that still needs to be addressed as a policy issue, and that's where are we going to house juvenile offenders that are certified as adults? If it's still in the state prison system, then we have some major capital budget issues that we have to deal with because we're not set up for them to be sight and sound separate.
So this is a relatively new federal law. You and prison system officials around the country are going to have to make some major structural changes, keeping those 17-year-olds completely separate from the rest of adults, or change the law and say 17-year-olds are now juveniles again.
We have to do something here, because we have to supply to the federal government essentially a letter that says we're in compliance with this law, and frankly, right now, we can't do that because of the sight and sound separation issue. And, you know, another little twist to this, we get so few juvenile offenders in the prison, even if we had an area that was sight and sound separate, if we only had one individual in there, that's considered segregation, and we wouldn't be allowed to do that either. So we have some real issues with this new while we agree with the PREA law, we do have some issues with the particular impact of the law as it stands with our prison system here in New Hampshire.
So last question on this. If the legislature does go ahead and do this and Governor Hassan signs it, it's still an if, does that just eliminate the problem for you?
Problem solved. It does not. It helps a little bit. But we still have to make a decision on what we're going to do with those juvenile offenders that then become certified as adults because of the crime that they were involved in.
I see. So even if the law states in general 17-year-olds are now juveniles, let's just say that it's changed, if some 17-year-old commits a really terrible crime, a judge can say, you know, you're certified as an adult, you're going to the Concord prison on South Main Street.
That's what would happen right now. What I'm asking the legislature to do is to study this and determine whether or not, say, for instance, the Sununu Center in Manchester would be a better place to house those that are certified as adults until they became 18 and then to bring them into the prison system. Otherwise, like I said, we have some major capital budget issues we have to address.
And I misspoke. The prison is not on South Main Street. It's on State Street.
State Street.
State Street.
Yes.
The Berlin Prison. We've talked so much about many of the issues that are familiar to folks in Concord and the surrounding area with the big state prison there. What about Berlin, Commissioner Wren? Are the issues different there or not?
No, really. They're the same. It's just another location for us. But we still have the same issues at the Berlin prison that we face here at the Concord prison. We're all one unified system. So
again, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Here's a Facebook comment from Deb. She says, can the commissioner talk about any plans he may have to work with the SB 413 health insurance program just passed to help the people being released from prison get connected to health insurance and thereby get substance use or mental health treatment? Deb says, what can he do when people are preparing for transitioning out of prison to get connected with this health insurance program, since so many of them do need treatment? This, again, is the Medicaid expansion.
Yes.
Right, Commissioner? Yeah.
Yes. And our case managers are going to be working, and our health officials are going to be working with the inmates as well as the folks at the Health and Human Services to determine their eligibility and then to get them signed up, you know, when they leave. We already do that now. As I said, we've been doing this since 2008. We've been signing people up. And since 2008, I think we've saved about $2 million in medical expenses because, like I said, anybody that is an inpatient in the hospital over 24 hours that meets the Medicaid definition, we get reimbursed for that money. So we've been doing this all along. We're going to have much larger numbers to deal with, but we're going to be ready for that.
Well, and I'll ask you what I asked Lori, our counselor who called earlier. It's one thing to sign somebody up for Medicaid. It's another thing to find a provider willing to take them who has room in their schedule. A lot of providers are booked up already. I've heard that there's a serious shortage, for example, of child psychiatrists.
And that's the key. And that's why I said earlier that we're hoping that with the introduction of these new definitions for Medicaid eligibility, that's going to create a larger market of treatment that's available in our communities. You know, years ago, we used to have, even some of the hospitals had psychiatric units that you could go to when you had a problem. But they stopped running those units because, frankly, the money just wasn't there. You know, perhaps with the Medicaid expansion now, maybe you'll see that, starting to occur again, where hospitals will open up a psychiatric wing and start to provide some resources there. Or we may get more treatment providers available in the community. That's what we're hoping for.
I want to ask you, Commissioner Rand, about the new women's prison. This was many years in the making. As I understand, ground will be broken this summer behind the men's prison in Concord. People have talked about this for a long, long, long time. What were some of the concerns that finally pushed this to the forefront to the point where they're going to be breaking ground this summer?
Well, this has been my number one capital budget project, I think, since I've been with corrections. And, we're finally seeing it come to fruition today. And a lot of that push to get this moving was because of a lawsuit that was filed by our female offenders. But there was a desire also by a lot of people, including Governor Hassan, and including many members of our legislature that have been supporting this idea for a long time. And I really thank them for their support in moving this along because it's really needed. Right now, it's a process that we're going through in the design phase and in making sure that everything fits within the budget. And we keep going through different modifications of our design because prices change and we're trying to get everything into the budget format. But we're really excited about this as we move forward, and we're really excited about the idea that perhaps by the end of 2016, we may be walking into a new women's prison.
2016 is the hoped-for date. Yes. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Mike's calling from Concord. Hi, Mike. You're on the air with Commissioner Wren. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Hi, Commissioner Wren. How are you?
Good morning.
Good morning. My situation may be unique to some of the other callers in that I actually spent time at the prison and also in Vermont and Kentucky. I did a seven-year stint in the three places, and I ended up in Concord and I was released from there. My feeling is that there should be more focus on treatment to the individual when they're first convicted of a crime. I went through not claiming to be the victim. I knew I screwed up, and I wanted to take responsibility for it. Not all people do that. But I think with a little bit of help early on the initial intake, if a particular treatment could be with whatever compulsion or addiction the person may have, if they're given a treatment plan and they follow through that treatment plan, it could be considered, you know, an early release situation. And I know there's mandatory minimums, but if something could be done there, giving someone a chance to take responsibility while they're still in the shock phase of what they may have done, figuring out how they could potentially restart their life after, you know, hitting a wall. I think that that would be the best way forward. And also, I agree with Commissioner Wren that not all people can be treated, but to give them the option.
Okay. And this has been an issue. Thank you very much for calling in, especially given your personal experience with the corrections system here and in other states. You know, this is an old theme, isn't it, Commissioner Wren? Time off for good behavior.
It is. And currently there's a bill going through the legislature right now called the Earned Time Bill, which would give inmates time off their sentences if they did positive things within the prison system for positive change, getting their high school diploma, getting their high school equivalency, going to mental health treatment or substance abuse treatment, could earn them some time anywhere up to, I think, about 13 months off their original sentence. That is going through as an incentive to get folks, number one, to get an education while they're in our prison and to comply with their need to get some sort of treatment in there. So when they leave the prison system, we're hoping that they're going to be better off than they were when they came in and maybe have some tools that will help them be successful when they leave.
Thanks a lot for calling in, Mike. Commissioner Wren, I have to ask you a tough one here. You have a man on death row, Michael Addison. Is there an official death row at the state prison?
Well, he's in our special housing unit, which is our C5 high restrictive unit.
That Rose talked about earlier, our caller. Yeah.
It's one cell that's set up for him. He will be there until the time comes for his execution or if the law should change in the meantime. But he will be there forever. He will have no ability to move out of that high restrictive unit.
Governor Hassan has said even if the law is repealed, she will not use that as a way to overturn this conviction.
Yeah, I understand that's her position, yes.
Yeah. So how closely are you, Commissioner Wren, watching the legal back and forth in this case, knowing that, you know, if in the end Michael Addison is to be executed, you folks are going to have to carry that out?
Well, it's something obviously we're going to have to face at some period of time if that continues to be the law. We haven't done it since 1939, so we're going to have to be looking at other states, and we've already started to upgrade some of our policies with that surround executions, and we've visited a couple of states already just to see how they handle it. But it's going to be new territory, essentially, for us since it's been since 1939.
We started off, Commissioner Wren, talking about this push by U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder to reduce nonviolent drug sentences, other states closing down prisons. What are your expectations, Commissioner Rand, about where New Hampshire ultimately might fit within these national trends? Will we be going with them or not?
Boy, that's a hard question to answer.
I promise not to hold you to it in 5 years.
I certainly support the direction that the Attorney General is headed in here, and I've been an advocate of this for quite some time. However, sometimes change at these high levels tends to be very slow. I think as we continue along here, the legislature is getting better at understanding that change is needed. And as we keep continuing to talk about, we have to get smart on crime, not soft on crime. We have to get smart on crime and start doing it the right way and perhaps in the long run save some money as well.
All right. Commissioner Wren, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks, Laura.
That's Commissioner William Wren. He's head of the New Hampshire Department of Corrections. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Alan Cohen. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. A Senate committee hears testimony on a House bill to repeal the state's death penalty law. Another Republican plans to jump into the New Hampshire governor's race, businessman Walter Havenstein. And limited backyard chicken farming comes to Manchester, despite a few clucks of dissent. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Public Radio with the Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Upton and Hatfield, serving the legal needs of individuals, municipalities, businesses, and school districts for the Granite State for over a century. Online at UptonHatfield.com. And the Rudig Group, serving successful families and businesses with sophisticated planning and investment management for over 30 years at UBS Financial Services, member FINRA SIPC.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Yesterday, the Supreme Court struck down overall limits on federal campaign contributions. It's considered, in some ways, a follow-up to the court Citizens United ruling 4 years ago. And like Citizens United, the decision